You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you for coming to this talk, which is by Susan Landau, which is part of Lens on Privacy and Security, being run this term by the Berkman Center and in collaboration with the Center for Research on Computation and Society from the School of Engineering. Before introducing Susan, I just want to mention, for people who may not be aware, that everything is webcast live, so everything is on the record. Our speaker today, Susan Landau, began her career at Wesleyan University as a faculty member working in theoretical computer science on algebraic algorithms. And then in the 90s, as a faculty member at UMass, because of the battles over crypto export controls, she became very interested and active in policy issues, wrote a very influential book with Diffie on the politics of wiretapping and encryption, and then at then she moved to Sun, where she's a distinguished engineer, and continued to work on policy issues, and worked on Dream, one of the only DRM system to provide for fair use. She has advised the government on privacy and security policy issues for many years, testifying and serving on various commissions. She's a winner of the 2008 Women of Social Impact Award. She is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a distinguished engineer of the Association for Computing Machinery. And it's a great pleasure to have her here today to tell us about her new book, Surveillance or Security on Wiretapping. She will be signing books. Books are available for purchase in the back, and she will be doing a book signing at the end of the talk. Thank you, Susan.
I have this one on. So thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's great to be in a place where there is computer science, policy, and law all in the same place, because these issues really are about computer science, policy, and law. And what I'm going to talk about today is wiretapping, what the FBI is most interested in. And you'll hear me say FBI a lot, because there really seems to be a conflict between different parts of the government. It's not explicit, but I will point out how it's occurring. And it's all occurring within an international setting. People are using their BlackBerries not just in the US and Canada, but in places like Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, and India. And those governments have trouble with the idea that they're encrypted communications that they can't listen to. So where the problem all comes from is that we once used to have telephones that sat in one place. And it was pretty easy to wiretap. What you did is you put a tap on somewhere between the phone and the central office, the first phone office that the communication went through. You could do it in the basement of the apartment building. You could do it at the phone central office. But you could do it. When we went to cell phones, it turned out it wasn't a whole lot harder to tap. There are places where cell phones are slightly more complicated, but it still was a centralized communication. Part of the reason that it was a central, the reason it is a centralized communication is completely technical. Turns out that analog voice, every time the voice goes through a switch, it gets degraded. And AT&T, the phone company, didn't want degraded voice, so they architected their system so that your voice went through at most 5 switches. That creates a very centralized system. It also creates a system that's easy to wiretap. Easy in the sense of being technically easy. So the public switch telephone network was easy to wiretap, but it turns out that some types of internet communications are not hard to wiretap. For example, any type of internet communication that's centralized. So your Gmail travels to a centralized server that Google controls. Your Facebook communications are under Facebook servers. Those are technically easy to wiretap. I don't mean it's completely simple, but I mean it is does not provide a technological problem. On the other hand, if the communication is peer-to-peer, as Skype is, it becomes very difficult to wiretap. And that's part of the problem that the FBI is running into, the FBI and state and local law enforcement. So I will do my one technical slide for you. It's Alice and Bob talking on the telephone. Alice and Bob, for those of you who are cryptographers or computer scientists, Alice and Bob are crypto people. Alice is sitting at the airport lounge. Bob is at a coffee house. Alice is connected to a local ISP at the airport lounge, Fly ISP. Bob is connected to a local ISP at the coffee house, SIPS ISP. But they both have ISPs they use for voice over IP communications. Bob's is Packet Talk and Alice's IP voice. So when Bob decides he wants to talk to Alice, he says, I want to have a VoIP conversation with Alice. SIPS ISP says, Bob's VoIP provider is Packet Talk, and sends a message to Packet Talk. Packet Talk says, Bob wants to talk to Alice. Alice is at IP voice and sends a message to Alice. So far, the communication is going up and across all the way up. IP voice says, let me see if Alice is online. Gee, Alice is online. She's at Fly ISP. Fly ISP can give me her IP address, can tell me where she is on the network right now. So IP voice and Packet Talk do what's called a rendezvous. They exchange the information of where Bob and Alice are. Bob gets Alice's IP address, Alice gets Bob's IP address. Then Packet Talk and IP voice drop out of the picture, because SIPS ISP learns where Alice is, Fly ISP learns where Bob is, and their communication travels through the internet cloud. This is what complicates wiretapping in the peer-to-peer world, because law enforcement knows Alice's or Bob's VoIP provider and gives them a wiretap order, says to Packet Talk, we want to wiretap every conversation Bob has. But all that Packet Talk knows is where Bob is right now. Packet Talk has to somehow tell SIPS ISP securely and in a way that SIPS ISP trusts that Bob should be wiretapped. But SIPS ISP also has to be trusted by the system. How do we know that SIPS ISP isn't in Bob's pay and that way Bob can find out that he's being wiretapped? That's the problem that the FBI is facing. The peer-to-peer communications of Bob and Alice, which do not go through the VoIP providers, provide one of the serious complications. The other serious complication is encryption. So where does all this right to wiretap come from? Well, there are whole courses at the law school taught on the Fourth Amendment. There are whole courses on the law school taught about wiretapping. I'm going to do all of this in under 3 minutes or 5 minutes. So bear with me. The protection against the government tapping comes from the Fourth Amendment, which says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, places, and effects shall not be against unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated. And warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, describing in particular the person and place to be searched. The government is not allowed to do a generalized search. The government has to specify who they're wiretapping, what number they're wiretapping, the location. With time, that's shifted some as people's phones move, as people become more expert, as bad guys become more expert in getting rid of phones, using a whole set of phones to take calls. And the government has been required to provide less information in that way. But this is the privacy protection that's imposed upon the government on wiretapping. We have a whole series of wiretap laws, federal wiretap laws, starting in 1968, the Title III wiretap law, which delineates under what circumstances the government can wiretap in criminal cases, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which delineates the same situation for foreign intelligence. Then in 1994, we had a very strange law that passed. And the law didn't say what are the circumstances under which the government can wiretap. The law said the telephone companies have to design their switches in ways that can accommodate wiretapping. Didn't say here's the requirements that law enforcement must satisfy in order to wiretap. It said, here's the requirements that the phone companies must build their switches to. It's a technological mandate on the phone companies. Then in the last 10 years, we've seen a whole lot of laws. I will talk about them briefly, but I really want to focus on the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, CALEA. So the Communications Assistance for Foreign Law Enforcement Act came from the situation that we had telephones that sat in one place and a telephone company that in some sense sat in one place. Until the early 1980s, we had one phone company, AT&T, and one provider of phones, AT&T. So if law enforcement wanted to wiretap, they dealt with one company and one provider of services. All of a sudden, when AT&T got split up, there were a lot of different phone companies, a lot of different providers of telephones, and also new services. And law enforcement ran into trouble. They had trouble putting on the wiretaps. They were concerned about digitally switched networks. So the kinds of problems they ran into is call forwarding. The way call forwarding works is the call comes to the phone switch nearest to the person, and instead of the phone call traveling down to the phone wire to that person, it gets switched at that switch and travels to wherever the phone is being forwarded to. But the wiretap had been right at the switch after that change. And so what that meant is that if call forwarding was put on the call, law enforcement couldn't get a wiretap on. Now, there were ways to fix it, but law enforcement didn't want to have to do it in each special case. So they went to Congress. They went in 92, didn't get anywhere. In 94, they got somewhere. And where they got was the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which says all digitally switched telephone networks must be built wiretap accessible with the switches designed according to the standards developed by the well-known telephone agency, the FBI. I say it as a joke, but in fact it was very complicated. The law was passed in 94. All telephone networks were supposed to comply by 98. The situation was so bad that Congress did an extension to 2001. The whole situation was litigated for years. Because at the time the law was passed, the telephone companies thought that they would have agreements with law enforcement. Instead, law enforcement imposed its technological mandates on the phone companies. Well, we had that law, and it applied to digitally switched telephone networks. There was a clear exemption for what were called information services. If you go and you look at the law, it says this does not apply to information services, which in 1994 meant the internet. But in 2003, law enforcement came back and said, we're having trouble with the internet. In particular, they were having trouble with voice over IP. And what they asked for at the time was for CALEA to be extended to voice over IP communications. What the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and the courts eventually agreed upon was that CALEA would be extended to those cases of voice over IP that look like the telephone network. So let me explain what I mean. I showed you Skype, where when you Skype, you go through the internet cloud. It looks nothing like the centralized telephone network. But there's some uses of voice over IP that look very much like the telephone network. You can sit in your office. You probably do sit in your office at Harvard. I don't actually know about the system at Harvard, so I'm saying a probably here. Sit in your office at Harvard. It looks like a telephone. It may, in fact, be a telephone. I know at my house what I have is a real telephone. I have one of those 1950s phones that I've been showing you pictures of. In fact, that's a picture of my phone. I have a phone like that. It calls in to the telephone central office. I would be very surprised if from the telephone central office all the way to my friends who also have big black squat telephones, or my mother, I would be very surprised if in the middle it looked anything like the old circuits of before. It probably is voice over IP. Well, to do that kind of wiretapping is still very easy because even though it's voice over IP in the middle, at the endpoints between me and the phone office, it just looks like the plain old telephone. At the other end, it looks like the plain old telephone. And so you put the wiretaps at the phone central office, you can do the same thing. So the FBI got an exemption for that in 2005. It began asking for it in 2003, got it in 2005. I want to fill you in just a little bit more about what's happening in the world because I think it's useful for you to have the whole picture, and then I'll go back and concentrate on CALEA. This is a map of the communications pattern in the world. You might notice that, you know, as always, the U.S. is in the middle of the picture, but in this case, there's a very strong reason for it, namely all the cables coming in. So if you're in South America and you want to call South America, if you're in Argentina and you want to call Brazil, chances are that you call by way of a switch in Miami. Why is that? The old way of calling between Brazil and Argentina was satellite, and that's a quarter-second delay. People don't deal well with quarter-second delays. But if there's a fiber optic cable between Brazil and Miami and a fiber optic cable between Argentina and Miami, the call happens like that. Well, when it goes through Miami, that's very nice for National Security Agency because, of course, it goes through Miami, they can tap, except they couldn't quite tap. Hold on to that thought for a moment. Let me give you another example. 20 years ago, you couldn't call from Taiwan to China because it wasn't allowed legally. But Taiwan could call to the United States. China could call to the United States. So the calls between Taiwan and China were routed through California. Now, AT&T was not dumb, and so it made sure that the contract lasted a long time. So even after it became possible to communicate China to Japan, China to Taiwan directly, the calls often went through California. Sometimes, because of the cable, calls between Europe and Asia are faster through the United States. Other things that cause communications to be centered in the United States, 10 years ago, we were the ones with Google and Yahoo and so on, all those servers located in the United States. Now some of those servers, the Gmail servers, are located in other parts of the world, but there's still a concentration here. All of that meant that the National Security Agency was very interested in tapping communications in the United States that physically occurred in the United States, that went through the United States, that were not of U.S. persons, that were not of persons in the United States, but their communication, but the communications of these people outside the U.S. went through the U.S. They'd had an exemption under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act where they could pick up any communication by radio as long without a warrant, as long as one of the pieces of the communication was outside the U.S. But between the time of the passage of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978 and middle of 2000, we'd moved from radio communications to fiber optics. So the NSA said they had a technical problem, that it was purely a technical problem. There'd been an exemption for radio communications where they could warrantlessly wiretap. They wanted that exemption for fiber optic cables. That was the warrantless wiretapping that happened between 2001 and 2005, 2006, when it was uncovered by the New York Times. Except it wasn't quite. Because I've been talking to you about where the cables come in. The cables come in places like San Luis Obispo. The warrantless wiretapping was happening in places like San Francisco, which pick up communications not only between China and Taiwan and between Europe and Asia, they also pick up communications between Silicon Valley and Washington. Protect America Act was passed for 6 months. It was a law that was passed in the summer of 2007. It lasted 6 months. It allowed the warrantless wiretapping. It was sufficiently controversial that it was had a timeline of 6 months. It was extended for 2 weeks. Then it lapsed. It was replaced in 2008 by the FISA Amendments Act. I could take more than an hour just describing all the different circumstances under which you do or don't need a warrant, depending on whether the communication is inside the United States, by a U.S. person, whether it occurs by radio, and so on. There'll be a quiz after on this map. This law also did one other thing, which is it said that there would be retroactive immunity for all the telephone companies that complied with the warrantless wiretapping. So in that sense, we have no ability to understand what actually happened. But let me go back to CALEA. And to do that, I need to talk to you about wiretapping and how efficacious wiretapping is. So a standard claim by law enforcement is that wiretapping is used in kidnapping cases and important other investigations and terrorism cases. When Diffie and I did our book a dozen years ago, we discovered that wiretapping is not used very often in kidnapping cases for fairly obvious reasons. You don't know who the kidnapper is, so it's pretty hard to tap him. And if the family allows you to tap, then that doesn't count as a wiretap either from the point of view of law or from the point of view of technology. You're just listening in on an extension, essentially. There are only 6 cases a year for which wiretaps are used. Of those 6 cases, those 6 cases come out of about 450 kidnapping cases annually. Other investigations, when the wiretap law was passed in 68, it may surprise you that it was used mostly in gambling cases, but that's because gambling was the main crime committed by organized crime. Now it's used in drug cases, and that's the overwhelming majority, something in the 85% case. In 2006, the Department of Justice said, we've had 441 defendants charged with terrorism or terrorism-related activities of international nexus. This sounds really bad. I'm not saying wiretaps were used in all of them, but these numbers sound bad. When you look more carefully, there are only 123 with prison sentences, 14 who had 5 years or more, 6 with 20 years or more. At the same time, you want to delve even deeper into these numbers because in some cases, all you do is get rid of the guys. They've been convicted, you get them out of the country. You don't care how long their prison sentence is. All you want to do is make a deal with them, get them out of the country. But if I'm telling you on the one hand that the wiretaps are not in such serious cases, let me give you a case where it was, in fact, very serious. So this case broke in late summer of 2009. And the New York Times stories, all the stories in the news were kind of weird. There was this guy, he'd immigrated from Afghanistan, lived in New York, family moved to Denver, then he went back to Afghanistan, went back to Denver, then he was driving to New York, he got stopped outside the George Washington Bridge, his car got searched, then he was picked up again as he was leaving New York. Didn't sound like much of anything, but each day there was another story and another story and another story and another story. And finally he pled guilty. And what you discovered is when he got back to Denver after being in Afghanistan, he had rented a hotel room. He had also bought a lot of chemicals from hairdressers that are used, hydrogen peroxide, that can be used to make the bombs. He'd bought massive amounts. Then he rented the hotel room again. You discovered after the second time he rented the hotel room, the FBI went in and investigated and found traces of drugs in the hood of the kitchen there, the hood over the stove, traces of the chemicals. The chemicals were being boiled down. You need to boil them down in order to build bombs. And you also discovered that he made 3 increasingly frantic phone calls the second time he was in the hotel. So I have only worked without classification for a number of reasons, including the fact that it's important to be able to discuss this in these issues of encryption and wiretapping in a non-classified setting. So what I'm telling you all comes from a non-classified setting. And what you discover from this particular case is it was the three calls picked up under a FISA tap, well, not even a FISA tap, under a warrantless tap that were picking up communications because they didn't have Zazi the first time. When they picked up the calls, they didn't know he was a person of interest or they would have looked at the hotel the first time. They only looked at it the second time after they picked up the calls, the 3 increasingly frantic calls. This guy was building material to blow up New York City subway cars in the same way that the London bombers had done in 2007. And he was picked up as a result of the wiretaps. At the same time, I need to tell you about a different picture. When the wiretap laws were passed in 1968, we didn't have cell phones. Phones didn't move. You knew where somebody, you wiretapped somebody, you knew where the phone was. Now all of a sudden we have cell phones and we have tremendous amounts of transactional information. So for example, the really bad guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the one who was behind the planning of September 11th, was picked up in Pakistan through his cell phone, the location of his cell phone. One of the bombers from the attempted bombings on July 21st in London, so 2 weeks after the original set of bombs in London, there was a set of attempted bombings. None of them actually did anything. One of the people fled to Rome, and he got picked up in Rome at his brother's house through tracking his cell phone. There was a case in Boston in which a guy was finding women on Craigslist for massages and so on. He murdered one. He assaulted 2 others. He was picked up because they noticed that somebody leaving the 2 of the hotels was checking his cell phone as he was leaving. They checked which cell phones had been in those sectors at that particular point, got a search warrant, searched his house, and got him. Those are all anecdotal. A somewhat less anecdotal one is that the U.S. Marshals Service has cut its investigative time from 42 days to 2 days. Because when you've got a fugitive, you check where his phone is 10 p.m., where his phone is 8 a.m., and then you check who of his friends and family lives in that cell phone sector. 2 days. Transactional information is remarkably revelatory. So I need to point out, as has become increasingly clear over this talk, that we're not living in the communications world of your parents or my parents. Phones don't move. In 1950, in order to make a phone call to Europe, you had to book it in advance. In 1970, you didn't have to book it in advance. You could just do it. And now you can call somebody anywhere in the world, and you don't even know where they are. You just dial it. It's really amazing. It's also not your parents' business world. We've moved everything online. We've outsourced everything. We have critical infrastructure being controlled through the internet. Many of these things are not actually very secure and shouldn't be done, but that's the world we've moved to. It's also changed in other ways. Everybody carries communications devices, many of which are encrypted. We've also moved to a world in which every telecommunications service is using the same type of switch. So 40 years ago, we didn't have one switch powering all the networks. Now you figure out how to break into a Cisco switch when you're sitting in Estonia. You figured out how to break into a Cisco switch that's in Washington, D.C. And not only that, you can get to that switch. Building wiretapping into communications infrastructure, whether into the applications or into the switches, creates risks. It creates risks in two different ways. You remove the carriers from the decision about implementing the wiretap, and you remove forms of minimization. The law is really clear that you're supposed to minimize a wiretap. You're only supposed to tap the person who is the subject of the wiretap, and only when they're talking about issues related to the criminal activity. But when you build wiretapping capabilities in, both of these things somewhat disappear. You run the risk that the wiretap will be exploited by bad guys and possibly by law enforcement not being as careful as it should. And similarly, you run the risk of overcollection. And let me tell you now some instances that make it clear that the claims I'm making are not hypothetical. The first is Greece. So Greece, Vodafone Greece, bought a switch from Ericsson, a Swedish manufacturer. Vodafone Greece did not want wiretapping capability in the switch, so they didn't pay for it. But when Ericsson updated the switch, the update included the capability to wiretap. It didn't include the interface that allowed Vodafone Greece to control the wiretap, because wiretapping wasn't supposed to be part of the deal. It also didn't include the interface that turned on the auditing of the wiretap, because wiretapping was not part of the deal. But wiretapping capability was in the switch. Somebody went into that switch, turned on the wiretapping capability on 100 senior members of the Greek government, including the prime minister, the head of the Ministry of Defense, the head of the Ministry of the Interior, and so on. That wiretapping went on for 10 months because whoever went into that switch also included a rootkit that allowed them to update the wiretapping capability every time the switch got updated. They screwed up one time because after an update, some text messages went awry. Vodafone Greece went to investigate, discovered the wiretapping. The wiretapping stopped. I've now explained to you how the wiretapping occurred. What I'm not explaining to you is who did it, because I don't know. Nobody knows who did it except for the people who did it. Okay. 10 months, 100 senior members of the Greek government. In Italy, 6,000 people were wiretapped for a period of 10 years illegally. This included members of the judiciary, political people, celebrities, sports figures. Presumably it was done for blackmail and bribery. The case is slowly wending its way through the courts. This looks very much like an insider job, but since it hasn't finished going through the courts, it's hard to tell. 6,000 people in Italy out of a population of 60 million means 1 in 10,000 people was wiretapped. Actually, it means more than 1 in 10,000 people was wiretapped, because everybody who was wiretapped, everyone they communicated with, was also tapped, of course. It means that no major business deal and no major political deal happened in private. And lest you think this is only European, last year at the Black Hat Conference, an IBM researcher, Tom Cross, was studying a Cisco architecture for enabling wiretapping within a Cisco IP switch. And the Cisco architecture was fine. The problem was it made recommendations rather than requirements. And the recommendations included encrypt this with this secure encryption, encrypt that with this secure encryption, and so on. But it didn't require that it be encrypted that way. So if you didn't encrypt it that way, you could spoof the switch and look like you were an authorized person to do the wiretapping. Why is that a problem? Well, if you go back to the FBI, Robert Hansen, who was one of the worst spies the FBI ever had, was able to fool the auditing system and look at what was happening and who was auditing him and so on, who was following him. Not having good auditing systems in wiretapping systems is disastrous. What Cross found out is that implementations without the adequate encryption requirements implemented would have already been deployed in various systems. Making it easy to wiretap means there's going to be more wiretapping. So this is a story the FBI doesn't like to hear. In 2001, right after September 11th, the FBI set up a unit in conjunction, the Communications Assistance Unit, in conjunction with AT&T, Verizon, several other carriers, to get at transactional information quickly. Remember that transactional information is remarkably revelatory. And the Patriot Act had given them the ability to use what's called national security letters, something simpler than subpoenas, to get at this transactional information. But everybody was really anxious immediately post-September 11th, and they wanted something even simpler. So they had these exigent letters. Give us this information now, we'll write you a national security letter later. Sometimes they just actually said, give us this information now, we'll write you an exigent letter later. Other problems, the guys were set up right next to each other. They went out to lunch together, they went out for beers together. What do you think happened? All the things you might expect when there isn't a barrier between the people who have the information and the people who are requesting the information. The exigent letters were never followed up with national security letters. Data was given without written requests. The FBI had hot numbers. They'd say, I think this number's interesting. Run it for me. Tell me who he's communicating with. Forget it. I'm not going to follow that one up. There was a lack of specificity in the written requests, and so one that I find particularly appalling has to do with a Washington Post reporter. The FBI believed that this particular reporter had been talking to terrorists in the reporter's job of writing investigative pieces. They didn't believe the reporter was doing anything wrong, simply that the reporter was speaking to terrorists and they wanted to track the reporter. They didn't put any dates on the tracking of this transactional information. Tracking whom a reporter speaks to really impedes the reporter's job. Because of the First Amendment, we have the Code of Federal Regulation, which says you want transactional information on a reporter, you need the written signature of the Attorney General to get the transactional information. It's not a requirement in the law, it's a requirement in federal regulation. You need written signature of the Attorney General to get at that information, because otherwise you can destroy the freedom of the press with this act, with this kind of behavior. Instead, there was no specificity on the requirements, and they got the reporter's transactional information for 7 months, even though the reporter was speaking to this terrorist, alleged terrorist, for a very brief period of time. Community of interest, very powerful tool that AT&T developed. Person, let's find everybody that person is talking to. Let's find everybody else that those people are talking to, and so on. You can develop a very quick community. They developed this tool, useful tool. FBI would say, run community of interest for me. No written requests. No ability to track what the FBI was doing. The FBI got very badly slammed by its inspector general. So, in this world, we need to think about what are the threats we're facing. And there's, of course, the non-state actors. For those of you who are too young, this is Kim Philby, who was he was spying for the Soviets for 30 years before he was uncovered. He was spying, working within the British intelligence system, disastrous for the British intelligence system. And then, of course, so this is nation state, this is insider attack, and then this is nation state. Those are the threats we face. But in terms of the threats on getting within our communication system, these are the two. We don't really so far have to worry about those non-state actors. These are the two who are serious. And in the inside, in the, I have one other nation state. It is not just China, but in fact other countries as well, and I'll come back to that in a bit. The threats from non-state actors have all been, as I've said, relatively small. They're not small if you're living near the Worcester Airport or you're trying to fly out of Worcester Airport and it turns out it's closed for 6 hours because some kid got into the phone switch there and was able to fiddle with the phone switch. It's not small if the sewage treatment plant in Australia releases gallons of untreated sewage in the place you like to swim and so on. But these are all, as you look at them, relatively small attacks. By contrast, when you think about insider attack, they're historically the most dangerous type of threat. And the reason for that is they know your systems, they know your auditing systems, they know your vulnerabilities, they know how to do really bad things to you. So now think about insider threats and the idea of building wiretapping capability into the phone network, into the communications network. Need I say more? This most serious threat, however, we face is from state actors. So about 2004, 2005, the US government began being public about attacks from state actors. And the first one that they publicized was something called Titan Rain, in which somebody went into four defense establishments over 8 hours, four unpatched defense establishments, and took out very interesting files. They'd obviously been in before because they knew exactly what they wanted. They went in quickly, took them out, shipped them overseas. They went first, I believe, to Taiwan and Korea, and then to China. First we heard of it. All of these had exactly the same unpatched vulnerability. But since then, it seems to me you can't open your newspaper without finding a story, whether it's GhostNet, the Trojans hidden within emails, where apparently the Chinese, and I say apparently because we can't do full attribution, but apparently the Chinese went in and were checking the emails, Gmails of human rights workers and people associated with the Dalai Lama. In 2009, Northrop Grumman released a report describing very sophisticated targeted emails that went into Northrop Grumman, that went into targeted emails and other types of attacks, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Oak Ridge National Labs. Name your favorite major US company, name your favorite company abroad. It was the subject of such an attack. These emails and other things contained malware that allowed the intruders to come in, spy around, and then at some point they took files of interest and took them out very quickly. Google was the one that announced it in 2010, but the Google attack was similar to all the other attacks that I'm describing. William Lynn, who's Deputy Secretary of Defense, said last summer in a foreign affairs piece that the biggest long-term cybersecurity threat the United States faces is the theft of intellectual property. And he didn't mean films from Disney. He meant business plans, research, and so on. And that's coming from the Deputy Secretary of Defense. So is anybody spying? Well, in the Cold War, it was the Soviet Union, and they spied on our military establishment. But they figured out fairly quickly that our defense contractors weren't as well protected. And so they began spying on our defense contractors, and they had all sorts of clever ways. One of them that I find particularly interesting is that apparently when they were touring an airplane plant, they were wearing double stick tape on the bottom of their shoes to pick up a composite pieces of metal to discover what the stealth jets were like. But the complicated part of this type of spying was in order to arrange these sort of trade groups coming and visiting plants and so on, very labor intensive, very time intensive. Keep that point in mind. In the 1980s, it wasn't just the Soviet Union. It was countries you'd expect that didn't like us, but it was also countries that were our allies, France, Israel, Japan. Fairchild Semiconductor, for example, was the subject of an insider attack in which thousands of pages were taken over to the Japanese embassy by some insider. It was then the subject of a takeover by Fujitsu, and it was only the US government that prevented that takeover. What changed? Well, in 2003, the FBI estimated the cost as $200 billion, but nobody really knows the numbers. What changed in recent times is the internet. You no longer have to create all these trade delegations, establish all these contacts, and so on. You can do it sitting at a machine in Latvia, Estonia, Japan, China, wherever. And you can do it cheaply. I want to shift once more. I've been talking a lot about terrorism, I want to talk about natural disasters. We were all shocked by Katrina, but I did a little bit of work and checked how bad the numbers are in other disasters. Well, the Haitian earthquake was 230,000 dead. The tsunami was 283,000. If you look historically, you have numbers in the millions. So I went and talked to the Department of Homeland Security, and I said, well, what do you guys do during a disaster? Said, we can't use internet or cell phone because the phone networks and the physical networks might disappear. They might just get crunched the way they did both in Katrina and in September 11th. We go to you can't use satellite phones because there might be tall buildings or mountains or cloud cover. What first responders use is land mobile radio. And of course you know that. I mean, you see police cars traveling down the highway and you see they have all these antennas. Did you ever stop to think about why they have all those antennas? It's because their communication system works within their district, but it doesn't communicate with the police in the next district over, in the next county over. It doesn't communicate with the EMTs in the next county over. It doesn't communicate with the fire people in the next county over. So the first thing that DHS wants is interoperability, interoperability, interoperability. But then I went and I talked to the National Security Agency, and they want one more thing. They want security. They would like to see land mobile radio, secure, interoperable land mobile radio available for sale in Radio Shack. Okay, and then they went back and they said, we can't say Radio Shack because we can't pick a particular store, blah, blah, blah. I said, I'm sorry, you said Radio Shack, I'm going to use it. But here's the point. You have the National Security Agency pushing for secure, interoperable land mobile radio available cheaply for public sale. They want that because they want the first responders to have it. And the only way they'll have secure and interoperable if it's cheap. But at the same time, the National Security Agency is well aware of who else might get it. This is not the only place that the National Security Agency has been pushing for secure communications. In 2000, the US government changed its policy on encryption and said that the availability of strong encryption in products would be allowed for export, which also meant it would be allowed for use domestically. In 2003 or so, I can't remember if it's 2 or 4 or 3, the National Security Agency said that the Advanced Encryption Standard, a crypto system that's available in 128, 192, and 256-bit key, could be used for secret and top-secret communications, assuming it was in approved implementations. Public standard could be used for military and government communications to the highest level of secrecy. That, of course, has the effect of pushing a broader use of the advanced encryption standard in the public sector. In 2005, the NSA approved the use of a series of encryption standards, public encryption standards, for use for securing communications networks. What you've seen between 2000 and 2011 is the National Security Agency pushing for securing communications networks within the United States, public communications networks in the United States. It's not doing so with a great deal of fanfare, but you see the writing on the wall. Now you go back to last fall when the FBI announced via some New York Times articles that it was interested in expanding CALEA to other types of communications. If you read those peer-to-peer, doing stuff on encryption and so on, if you read those articles carefully, you might have noticed that it didn't say anything about what the State Department thought or what the National Security Agency thought. And there's still been no public information on that. Now, one thing is, of course, the NSA doesn't have to do wiretapping within the United States. Another thing is that the NSA has a different job than the FBI and local law enforcement. NSA has to gather intelligence, which is different from getting convictions. But the big thing is that the NSA has really moved to the side of securing communications. So when I say that, I'm saying that looking from the outside. I am not saying that as agency policy. Okay? Let me put this all in a slightly bigger historic context. The preamble to the Constitution, there's a very interesting line in there about securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Not just for now, but for forever. When you build wiretapping capability into a communications network, you build it in not just for now, but for a very long time. Switches last. The switches that were sold in 1975 are only being gotten rid of now. There's more updates to switches now, but switches last. Applications too. So what does society need in terms of communication security? Well, first of all, we need to enable secure communications when we have natural disasters. Okay? And natural disasters, as you saw, can cause quite a great loss of life. We need to secure civilian communications. You see business doing that themselves through VPNs, through BlackBerries, and so on. But as a matter of national policy, we should be heading in that direction. And of course, we need to enable law enforcement investigations of criminal and terrorism cases. What does it mean for law enforcement? Well, first of all, they should be using transactional information. They are, but they can probably use it even more. When I say we should secure the networks, that means that they're going to have to go to the end hosts. Now, I'm not arguing that people should have insecure end hosts, but I am pointing out that many people do have insecure end hosts. The FBI, in testimony 2.5 weeks ago, said, we don't want to do individualized solutions. We want bulk solutions. Well, you don't want bulk solutions if you're putting everybody's communications at risk. And in there also, I'm arguing that the FBI should be clever. Clever is expensive. So I find myself in the odd situation where I'm arguing that the FBI needs some more money. But I think that's true, because I think we need to secure our communications networks. The point is that CALEA isn't free. It's just not law enforcement who's been paying the bill. What are the principles that should guide us on communications security? Well, first of all, as the examples in Egypt and other places told us, security of communications is important for freedom, security, human dignity, and consent of the governed. Communications security should always be designed with the blessings, the freedom, how do I say it, principle of securing the blessings of freedom for posterity. When you build wiretapping into a network, whether through into an application or into a switch, you're unsecuring things for a long time. What that means is that you should never build, you should never have a law that says we're going to allow warrantless wiretapping for a long period of time. You should only have it for a very brief period of time, because then you then don't build it into the infrastructure. My third principle, which seems like it might be a small principle, but I think is in fact fairly quite important, is that communications and surveillance should not impede the working of the press, and that's because the press is the canary in the coal mine. I finished the text of the book a year ago, but all you have to do is look at what's happening in the Mideast to see how true that is. The Mideast and how China is now impeding the press in China. And then finally, I already spoke about this one, suspension of communications privacy must be brief, measured in days and weeks. So you all know that picture. You've all worked on that. The point is that standards last a very long time. Standards last much longer than the need to not get the keys from the E's and the T's and the S's tangled, and that's why it's a completely counterintuitive keyboard that we've been stuck with for 150 years. Standards last a long time. We need to take the long view and do communications security, not communications surveillance. Thanks very much. So I think Salil is in charge of the microphone.
We have plenty of time for questions.
My name's Shavani Rad. I used to be the executive director of a nonprofit internet service in Oregon, the Eugene Freenet. And when I was there, we would get law enforcement coming in through the front door 3 or 4 months apart, maybe. They always sent a different guy because I think they thought they'd get a different answer. But they'd come in, they'd sit there and say, we need all the email addresses from such and such an organization and the last month or 3 months of their email list traffic. This was back in the mid-90s, so that was, you know, where the content was. And somebody would sit there and say, oh, well, you know, let me get Chava. And I'd come out and sit there and say, hello, officer, how can I help you? And they'd say, we need this stuff. And I'd say, great, where's your subpoena? And consistently, the answer that I would get from them, the reaction I'd get would be, nobody else asks us for that. So when you talk about insider threats, can you comment on the insider threat of improper reaction of providers to the consumer?
The best example of that, there are two examples of that. The first example of that is the exigent letters, mm-hmm. Where all the rules just got lost in the process. And the second example is the warrantless wiretapping. And I think it's a tremendous failure that we passed a bill that stopped the court case. I was less interested in the funding, in paying back the people whose privacy was violated and so on and so forth. I really wanted to know what was the failure in the system. But
don't you think it's a lot simpler than that when people have privacy policies that sit there and say, we can give up your information on suspicion of wrongdoing?
So I think there are a lot of answers to your question. One of the answers is that currently under the legal regime we have, there are two kinds of ways that law enforcement gets at information related to communications. One is a wiretap warrant with a high level of proof for the content of the communications. The other is subpoena for the transactional information, which is a very low level of proof. I mean, nothing. We suspect. I think that there actually needs to be something in the middle, because the transactional information is much richer than it was in the days that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act was passed. And I'm giving you a legal answer. A process answer is, we need to educate. You were doing the right thing, and the people that I've just described at AT&T in the San Francisco office, as well as many other offices, and the people at the AT&T and Verizon, I can't remember who the other carriers were, working in conjunction with the Communications Assistant Unit, were not doing the right thing. US West was on the warrantless wiretapping. They were the ones who refused to do it. But on the exigent letters, that was a different case. So there needs to be education at all sorts of levels. I know back in the days of the old AT&T, violating the customer privacy was a really big deal. We've moved very far from that. And so there needs to be all sorts of pieces of things. And I'm giving you only part of an answer because there's too many pieces to give.
Hi, my name is Michael Rand. And my question is, how have recent events possibly muddied the waters in the sense of, let's say, Egypt, for example? In theory, as an ally, we would want at least some of their communications, for example, to be secure, although I suppose there are other parts of our government that want to wiretap them. But then, the protests start happening, et cetera, and people who perhaps were previously our friends, or at least nominally our friends, were no longer our friends. I mean, Tripoli and Libya, I guess, would be more of a case now. And then sort of related to that is, and vis-a-vis the future, is what impact do you think I read in the front page of the New York Times, Eben Moglen has a freedom box that he's working on. What impact do you think that'll have?
Part of the answer to your question is there is no such thing as the U.S. government. There are different parts of the government with very different agendas. So right now, law enforcement is pushing for let's change CALEA, let's get it this way or that way. They haven't come out with a specific proposal because there isn't interagency agreement. That seems pretty clear. At the same time, let me go back to the Defense Department. I'm not going to get the dates right. Let's say about 15 years ago, the Naval Research Labs began developing the onion routing, which allows anonymized communication over the network. Why should it be supported by the Defense Department? Well, if you've got people from the Navy sitting in a safe house in Tripoli or in somewhere in the Mideast and they want to communicate back with Annapolis, they don't want to give away that they're communicating with Annapolis. I can't give you specific instances of how that communication, how Tor is used, because of course that gives away, but I know that it's used by people in the Defense Department. It's used by law enforcement doing investigations. Both of those users work best if the other, if there are many other people using the network, because that hides them within this big crowd. So it's released as an open system, but it's developed by the Defense Department, supported by the State Department. So you're really asking a policy question about how do all these different things work. I think if you go back to 2000, when we changed our crypto regulations, I mean, I know the following. So let me explain a little bit about crypto, which this book is not about. It was the last book that was about cryptography. But in up until 2000, the U.S. government policy was to restrict the use of strong encryption in devices sold for export. This had the effect of restricting the use of cryptography in devices sold here, because companies didn't want to support two different systems, one with strong cryptography, one with weak. U.S. government changed policy in 2000 with the full support of the National Security Agency. A number of reasons for this. One is that when devices with strong cryptography were built in the United States, the NSA could knock on the door of the company and say, could we see that before you sell it? We just want to look at it a bit. But when it's being built in Sweden or Switzerland, they didn't have the same access. So it was beneficial to them to have the stuff built here, and there was danger of competition abroad. Another issue was that there were a number of bills in Congress that were going to loosen the controls. If the controls were going to be loosened, the NSA would prefer that it was done through regulation rather than through law, which they had little control over. Third reason was that the game was over anyway. Strong cryptography was going to be available. Communications were going to be encrypted. So what could the NSA do instead? Well, it could do what's called network exploitation, figuring out who was communicating with whom, figuring out all sorts of things about the network. But the only way they could do that, well, they were already doing some of that work. They needed more money. So they went to Congress. We said, we'll back off on the export control if you give us more funding for exploitation. So I've now described a scenario in which the NSA has said, game over on secure communications, but we'll try and find stuff that we need to find out afterwards. That's part of what I was talking about different missions. They don't have to convict the guy. I know only as much as I read in the Times. It seems like a good technology, but I only know as much as I read in the Times, so I can't say anything.
Device called a Freedom Box, which would allow people like reporters, et cetera, to communicate safely with others. And I think it works sort of like the MIT one child per laptop computers, where it's peer-to-peer type communication. And
so it's trying, what centralization exists within the network because of ISPs and so on, he's trying to have everybody be their own ISP in some sense.
And in this way, allow
for... So prevent the Egyptian government from shutting down the network. But shutting down the network depends partially on things like that, depends partially on how many cables you have running out of your country.
Thanks for your talk. My name is Kate Crockford. I work with the ACLU here in Massachusetts. And our national organization is involved in the Digital Due Process Coalition, which is many of you probably know about. It's EFF, and companies like Microsoft are also involved. And the goal is to pass an updated version of ECPA. Right. ECPA was passed in 1986 when cell phones were the size of a brick and the internet didn't really exist for most people. So my question for you is, as an expert on wiretapping and someone who thinks about these problems a lot, one, would you support updating ECPA? I assume so. And second, great. So what do you think are the most important, really, clearly in a way that most people can understand, the most important things to change about ECPA? Like what would dream ECPA look like?
So there are different parts of this, and one part that's very weird about the Electronic Communications Privacy Act is if you have mail on your laptop, you need government needs a wiretap warrant to get at the stuff on your laptop. But if you read Gmail or any other provider, a third-party provider, they need a subpoena to get at that information. They don't need a wiretap warrant. That's just an artifact of the way things have changed over time. Another change that has occurred is something I alluded to in my talk, the ability of transactional information to really reveal huge amounts about people. That's also available under subpoena. So we need a change there. At the same time, I know that law enforcement has some issues they'd like to change. I think in some sense, having the public discussion, I believe in public discussion, but I think there also has to be some closed room discussion going back and forth, because I think there has to be some trading back and forth. But I certainly the third party stuff of data on the cloud not having the same legal protection is all the reason why Microsoft and Google and so on participated, and it was not, I don't want to say just, but not just civil liberties groups. So the law has really not kept up with the technology in all sorts of ways, is the answer. But those are the two big ones for me.
I have a sort of a devil's advocate kind of question about how, you know, you're framing this as a trade-off between surveillance or security, and you can have to pick one, not get both. But you also have lots of examples of how on today's internet, adversaries are already capable of surveilling us, the ghost net, and basically taking advantage of insecurities within end-user systems. And so if you were to build in greater wiretapping access for law enforcement, would that, you may be introducing yet another way that adversaries could exploit, but given the vast availability of lots of other vulnerabilities that can be exploited for surveillance, what's the harm in introducing another one if in the event you're helping out law enforcement?
I did not plan Tyler's question, but it gives me the chance to say something that I meant to say and didn't.
Okay.
Which is the answer is when Northrop Grumman doesn't secure its network, it loses files from Northrop Grumman. But when you don't secure a communications switch or a communications application, you're putting at risk all the communications traveling through there, and it's a much bigger number.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, Barlow Keener. You know, in the past, the telephone company would, before there was a telephone company, there was no wiretapping.
Telegraph was wiretapped by Jeb Stuart.
Right, telegraph, right. Then the telephone came along, and you would get an order that had to be reviewed by the legal department inside and checked off, and you'd have the wiretap. And then all of a sudden, you had this massive amount of communication outside of that end-to-end closed network. And so, you know, from the law enforcement's perspective, this goes back to the security piece, how do you suggest, and I'm not advocating their side of it, except how do you suggest that they be able to discreetly seek out or get orders for particular information, you know, in a timely basis as they're happening? What's the answer here?
So part of the problem is that apparently they are still working. So there's both state and local, and there's FBI. Let me focus on FBI for an instant and then get to state and local. Apparently, FBI is still very much working on a case-based investigative method. So they don't say, gee, there is this new communications technology. At some point, we're going to have to wiretap. Instead, they have a case, and then they go to the provider. Gmail and Facebook are not problems technically. That information is in the clear. If it's encrypted, it's encrypted with keys that Google and Facebook have. There's no technical problem with getting at the information, but it doesn't come as timely in the first two or three cases as law enforcement would like because they haven't set that up. So the answer to that is, and I argued this actually in testimony in Congress a few weeks ago, they need to set up a better research arm. They have some research arm, they need to set up a better research arm. State and local are completely at sea because state and local don't have the resources. And there were FBI documents that were released under FOIA to the EFF about 3 weeks ago that describe the ad hoc procedure under which state and local law enforcement find out how to tap a particular kind of communications technology. That's nuts. State and local don't have the capability to investigate all these different kinds of things. The FBI should have a very good interface for state and local. So state and local doesn't have to call the one guy they know at FBI who says, gee, you know, so-and-so did a case like that a few months ago. Let me see if I can find out. That's not going to take care of everything. That's going to take care of a lot. That's a partial answer because I think there are only partial answers.
Okay, let's thank Susan.